Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of WN Movie Talk Podcast. I am Trev. I am your host for another episode of our film discussion and review podcast. Today, I'm going to do something a bit different. I'm going to start a new series again. So we've got the director's debut series. That's going to keep happening. We had Ron Howard's debut feature, Grand Theft Auto, the other day. That kicked off that segment of this show. And this week, I'm going to be kicking off another segment that I'm going to keep coming back to from time to time, which is movies of the 70s. Now, this is basically based on a set of books that I've bought by Jürgen Müller, and they are the movies of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. I've bought the set. It's a fabulous set of books. I've had the 70s one for ages. I've just recently sourced the 80s and 90s sets as well online. They're great books. They're huge, sort of A4 size books. Lots and lots of lovely images from the films that are discussed. It goes through the decade, year by year, and he's selected some of the most sort of pivotal films of the year and of the decade, in fact, the 70s. So the book, actually, they're great books. I'll put a picture of them up on my Facebook page, which is facebook.com/WNMovieTalkPodcast. And you can see them there. They're great books. For any film buff, especially one who's into the 70s, like me, you might love this book. It's sort of a great way of finding films that you may have missed. There's a lot of films in here that I have missed. But yeah, the 70s has always been my favourite decade for film. Recently, I have been watching a lot of the older films. I've been watching some more Ealing comedies and some older 1950s films from America, 50s and early 60s perhaps. But I always find it very stagey. You know, the acting is very hammy, melodramatic in the older films. It is harder to get into them. Some of them, you know, I'm not knocking them all. There's some absolutely amazing films there. But the other day I was watching The Man in the White Suit, which is an old Ealing comedy starring old Obi-Wan, Alec Guinness, when he was young man. And he plays this scientist who keeps working at these fabric manufacturers. And he's like created a fabric that doesn't get dirty. Basically, he's trying to create this fabric. And it's like, it's a great little film, good comedy, but the acting just seems very stagey, very theatrical. And that's what's great about the 70s movies, is that finally, you know, you've got films that are gritty and performed sort of so realistically, with actors like De Niro, sort of Gene Hackman, Jack Nicholson, sort of making their way into the movies. And they bring such realistic depth to their characters. You forget you're watching a film. You're not watching actors performing. You're just seeing these characters really come to life. And I think that's something that sometimes the earlier films sort of lack, when you have a lot of, like Alec Guinness in that film the other day, a lot of theatrical posing when someone talks to him and he's like, looks up in the air to one side, looking away from them. And you think, no one does that, you know, unless you're a performer on a stage. But the 70s, again, as I said, it was a real revolution in cinema. There was a lot going on in America and globally, on the global stage as well. But mainly with America, a lot of the films was these massive productions, and they was just flopping left, right and centre. Just like the Marvel films and the superhero films and the franchise films today, starting to, I don't know, they're not flopping enough, are they? But they're not making as much money as they could. So are we posed for another revolution? This is the question. But certainly in the 70s, they had sort of government distrust over the Watergate scandal. There is the Vietnam War, people are opposed to that. People are coming back from that with PTSD and not getting the help or assistance that they deserved. There was a lot of, you know, Americans didn't necessarily believe this glossy, massive productions that were being carved out at the time. And the B-movie from Roger Corman, as I mentioned in the Ron Howard episode the other week, Roger Corman was bringing out the B-movies, and a lot of young directors was leaving their film schools and going to work with him, learning the trade by knocking out these sort of exploitation films, bikers and murderers and car chases and all, you know, all that sort of malarkey going on. Films were being made on a budget and making good money. And then films like in the 60s, Bonnie and Clyde came around, where it's not a happy ending. It's, you know, violent for its time. You got comedians like Mel Brooks start making films, and everyone's sort of going away from the current style of filmmaking and creating brand new content that is pushing boundaries. The Graduate, another thing, you know, just a little drama about a young man who leaves college. He's got his degrees, but he doesn't know where his next step is. He doesn't know what he wants to do, you know. People, and these are films that people related to on a more personal level, and it opened the doors for these films to come out. Major studios taking a chance on younger talent, even letting the younger producers in, who was then, you know, opening the floodgates for directors like Francis Ford Coppola and Martin Scorsese to come bounding in. So, you know, and these kids had all been educated in film school, but they was looking at the work of like French and Italian filmmakers. Very European styles were starting to seep into the American cinema. And everyone, you know, was reading up, like Francois Truffaut had written about like the auteur, the director as an artist, basically, rather than just another cog in the wheel of like production. That the studios, you know, they had a very sort of a conveyor belt production method. Suddenly the director was given control over his own films. So all these kids had gone to film schools such as UCLA, and they'd learnt about this sort of style. So they was bringing something new. Audiences was lapping it up. So, you know, the 70s does eventually make way for the blockbuster era of the 80s again, with Spielberg and Lucas really being the ones who have redirected the path away from the little personal projects and the anti-establishment projects back into the big blockbuster movies. And I mean, these were groundbreaking times, the 70s. You know, profits from films just went ridiculous. And then they realized that rather than having small releases of films scattered across the country, they was just mass releasing films and realized just how much money they could make. You know, films like The Godfather, The Exorcist, Jaws, Star Wars being the real main crux of that movement, you know, which brought the 70s to an end as we know it. But still the 80s, you know, I've said I've bought the 70s, 80s and 90s, and all three of those books, I think they are my favourite era for cinema, American cinema especially. I say that, but then I've just sort of catalogued all my DVDs onto an app that I've got on my phone. But the data I've got on this app shows me that most of my films come from the 2000s. With only 95 from the 1970s. Now, I can't believe that, but there you go. 157 films from the 1980s, 199 from the 90s. And then, yeah, in the 2000s, it says that I own 334 films from the 2000s. But when I've looked in some films, the production year comes out as the date that they re-released the DVDs sometimes. So most of the DVDs were re-released through the 2000s. So that's irrelevant news that I've just given you. Didn't need to tell you that. The thing with this book as well, I mean, I love it. I've told you I love it. But the book starts from 1971. So if I bought movies of the 60s, which I haven't yet, I can't find it for as good a price as I could the 70s, 80s and 90s, to be honest. But we're going to have a look online and just see what movies was released in 1970 before we go in, have a look at the book and take it from there. So I've just dragged up online IMDb. I don't know how they're sorted by. Oh, they're sorted by popularity, user rating, or let's go US box office. So if we're now looking at 1970s, number one is Love Story, Ally McGraw and Ryan O'Neill. boy and a girl from different backgrounds fall in love regardless of their upbringing, and then tragedy strikes. Now, this was a massive hit for Paramount. Paramount were fading and struggling film studio, but basically they put a producer, young producer in place called Robert Evans, and this was one of his first films as producer that went on to have a massive draw. He ended up marrying Ally McGraw for a while, or dating her, until she ran off with Steve McQueen. All a bit gossipy. I learnt this from the book Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, but you could also see the same story if you watch the series The Offer on Paramount TV at the moment, which is all about the making of The Godfather. So, love story was never seen it myself. Airport is number two. Now, this is what IMDb is telling me is sorted by box office gross, American box office gross. Oh, number two is Airport. So a bomber on board an airplane, an airport almost closed by snow and various personal problems of the people involved. So it sounds like the film that Airplane is based on, but it's not, because I've got that. The film that Airplane's actually based on is called Zero Hour. And it's incredible how close they are. They've basically just took the script from that and added jokes to it. But Airport, 1970, so a whole 10 years before Airplane, the disaster movie is still striking hot in the American box office. But number three is MASH from 1970. Now, I picked this up only the other day, so I think I will be doing an episode on MASH shortly. It is one of those films that I used to love when I was younger, as a teen. I used to love the program as well, but then when I sort of started getting into films and I realized that it was a Robert Altman movie before it was the series, and I read the book as well. Great film, good performances. I love Altman's direction, the way he just sort of has people talking over the top of each other. It all seems, again, very real. This is the 70s starting to kick in here. Another war movie next is number four is Patton. Now, the World War II phase of the career of the controversial American General George S. Patton, played here by George C. Scott, in a screenplay written by Francis Ford Coppola before he was famous as a director. So still war films are doing well, you know, because Tora, Tora, Tora came out in the same year. That's down at number nine. I haven't seen any of the other films in the top 10 there. Next film I've seen is number 11, Catch 22. Five Easy Pieces in 1970 as well, which is Jack Nicholson plays a dropout from upper class America, picks up work along the way on oil rigs when his life isn't spent in a squalid succession of bars, motels and other points of interest. So again, that's another sort of a gritty role. Much the same sort of vein as the Graduate. Someone from a wealthy background, sort of not knowing, you know, what they want to achieve with their life and what they want to be, I guess. So again, it's questioning sort of the class system and privilege, I guess. And this is all the sort of films that we see starting to pour their way in. You still get in the occasional Western films like Chisholm and Two Mules for Sister Sarah. But also this year, I will just point out that Waterloo came out, which I watched recently after watching Napoleon, and I dug this film out. And now this is all about the Battle of Waterloo. Follows Napoleon Bonaparte on one side, but you also follow Wellington, the British, and you see both sides sort of planning this battle. And it's an amazing film. The scale and scope of this movie, the extras flooding the landscape, you see them going off for miles. You know, battalions of extras dressed in full Napoleonic gear on horseback with weapons. It just is impeccable. You know, even the CGI films of today, they look impressive, but they're not as impressive as this. This was all there. But it was ranked 35th overall in 1970. It was, for the money that was spent, it was a massive, massive flop. I did a video actually on films that you might want to watch if you liked Napoleon, Ridley Scott's Napoleon. I've done that back along. So have a look on our YouTube channel for that, WN Movie Talk over on YouTube. But another film that came out, which I haven't even got to yet as I'm scrolling down, is Cleopatra. Now, films like this and Waterloo, because they've spent so much money to create this all-out, massive, big-budget reconstruction of, in, you know, Cleopatra, so it's Egypt and that sort of time. And then when it came out, nobody wanted to watch it, and they just wasted all this money to create this spectacle of a film. And suddenly, you know, the studios were like, right, people don't want to see this. What do they want to see? And that's, of course, when, as I mentioned, the B-movies, the younger directors, all start finding their place. So that's 1970. Now I'm going to open up the book of the 70s. So it's just really impressive. The introduction of this book looks closely at Stanley Kubrick's Clockwork Orange. It says, I love this quote, "Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange is one of the key cult movies of the 70s. It might be described as the hinge that links the 60s with the 70s, a skeptical critique of ideals formulated by the 60s student movement." And a lot of the 70s, there's a lot of skepticism about, a lot of distrust, and it certainly shows in the movies. Then also in the introduction, he goes on to discuss how, you know, there was a sexual revolution in cinema as well, which had started in the 60s, but, you know, films like Last Tango in Paris, you know, take it to new levels. Movies, especially American movies, started to make a lot more, you know, to be a lot more visually intriguing. Directors like Spielberg coming along, who weren't afraid to stick the camera on the floor to give that image a bit more sort of depth and scope, or the likes of Martin Scorsese adopting that much more of a sort of handheld documentary feel within the movies, with his films like Raging Bull and Mean Streets. But now we get on to the movies of the 70s. So we start in 1971. And the first movie that Mr. Muller, Jürgen Muller, presents us with is Straw Dogs. So on one side, you open the book, you got a nice full-size colour image, like glossy magazine sort of paper as well, of Dustin Hoffman holding a shotgun in his little green sort of parka jacket. So 1971, Sam Peckinpah directed this movie about an American writer, David Sumner, who moves in with his new wife, Susan George, Amy Sumner, into a village down in deepest, darkest Cornwall. Now, of course, you couldn't make this film nowadays without causing a bit of offence. But Peckinpah had been filming movies in the States. And it says here, after frustrating bickering over The Wild Bunch, Warner Brothers released a heavily edited version. So Straw Dogs presented Sam Peckinpah with a welcome opportunity to shoot in Europe for the first time, and more importantly, giving him independence from the big Hollywood studios. Now, sure, Straw Dogs, I live in the southwest of England. I'm in Devon, but I've been to this village. We stayed there. It's like quite near St. Ives. And one day I was actually measuring windows, and I was sat in this village, and I was like, I've been here before. It's something really familiar about it. And it was only a couple of weeks after I'd watched Straw Dogs. And when I went home and Googled it, because I didn't have the internet on my phone then, and it was like, that was where they filmed Straw Dogs, the little village called St. Burien. So, yeah, basically, I guess it's a bit of a Western, but in a European setting, basically, where Dustin Hoffman moves into this town with this village with his wife, and the locals don't take to him very well. And he's got people there repairing his roof, and they just sort of treat them with contempt. But there, if I turn over the next page, you see a picture of his wife, Amy, Susan George. And then underneath, highlighted in big letters, it says, "The film is a provocation and a diagnosis. It takes the hysterical debate about the portrayal of violence in the media to new heights, thus questioning its own right to exist. Withdrawal treatments of this kind are vitally necessary." There is a lot of violence in this. You know, at the end, he just, don't they go on like a bit of a killing rampage, which is, you know, not the most realistic thing, I shouldn't think. But there's also that rape scene in there, isn't there, where she is raped by the locals and she seems to be enjoying herself. And it was controversial at the time. I think Straw Dogs was even banned in the UK for some years. But There's another quote inside, and it says, "I can think of no other film which screws violence up into so tight a knot of terror that one begins to feel that civilization is crumbling before one's eyes." So, yeah, Straw Dogs is a great film, one I have to revisit. I've never seen the remake. They've remade it, haven't they? Of course they've remade it. They remake everything, but it didn't seem quite as interesting to me. I didn't even look for it. The next film is a Western called The Beguiled, starring Clint Eastwood. I, as you know, if you've been listening to this podcast, I've just only really started getting into the sort of Eastwood Westerns. So I will have to try and dig out this one and have a watch of it. It says, Union Corporal John McBurney, Clint Eastwood, has had his share of hard times. Seriously wounded after an intense battle, he comes upon a remote boarding school for girls in the middle of enemy territory. Barely conscious, he is taken in and administered medical care by the school's students and principal, Martha Farnsworth, Geraldine Page. His condition soon improves. Martha plans to hand him over to one of the frequent patrols at the first opportunity, which would seal the fate of the Northerner. So some of the highlighted quotes in here is, it's not only a different picture for Eastwood. In my opinion, it's his best film. Focus on film quote. Don Siegel, the director, portrays life in a boarding school where young ladies learn etiquette while war rages around them. The director has separated the school so radically from the world beyond it that the plot acquires a timeless quality. This is the story of a man who abuses the trust and the love of lonely women. A southern gothic horror story that is the most scarifying film since Rosemary birthed her satanic baby. So that sounds quite intriguing. Is it? It's gothic horror? It sounded more like a western, but as it, you know, it does, they mention horror there. I don't know if that's just because of the theme of it rather than the style of it. You know, and it tells you where it, what genre each film is in, and it just says western here. Straw Dogs was a thriller. The Beguiled is a Western. The next one's a gangster film from Great Britain, 1971, written and directed by Mike Hodges. It's Get Carter, Michael Caine as Jack Carter, also starring Britt Eklund. And isn't old Alf Roberts out of Coronation Street in it at the end? I love this film. I haven't watched it for a long time, and you know, not a lot of people know this, but I sometimes think Michael Caine is a bit overrated. But this is one of those films that is just perfect, and he is perfect in. Jack Carter is back in town, it says. Against the will of his syndicate, professional killer leaves London, returns to Newcastle where his brother has died in a peculiar road accident. Carter suspects murder, and he wants to find the culprits. So it is a story of revenge. Pauline Kael, a famous American film critic, she wrote, "There is nobody to root but the smartly dressed sexual athlete and professional killer, Michael Caine, in this English gangland picture, which is so calculated, cool, soulless, and nastily erotic that it seems to belong to a new genre of virtuoso viciousness. What makes the movie unusual is the metallic elegance and the single-minded proficiency with which it adheres to its sadism for the connoisseur formula." Again, taking sex and crime to new, more violent levels. One man against an organization. The courage and naivety of an individual versus the overwhelming power and sophistication of a system. Again, it's those 70s themes that seem to be speaking out at the moment, you know. The underdog wanting to take control of like the corrupt governments and corrupt authorities, you know, a lot of rioting going on at the time, the police beating up the students and all that sort of thing. So again, definitely a film that fits in to that idea of an evolving decade. Next we have Clute, 1971, a USA thriller starring Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland. Now, I've never seen this film. I recognize the name. I know it's gone down as a classic. A man has disappeared without trace. All efforts made at pinpointing the whereabouts of upstanding Pennsylvanian family man, Tom Grunman, have led nowhere. When the police declare the investigation closed, private detective and family friend John Clute takes on the case. So a bit of a detective, you know, the detective genre is still probably still going strong at this sort of time. Now, this movie is the first movie in the book which has a little statue in the corner, just a single one, which means it's won an award, Academy Award for Best Actress for Jane Fonda. And then inside there's a little quote. Jane Fonda dominates the film from her first to her last appearance in a brilliant performance that almost bursts the confines of the character she plays. She combines subtle expressiveness with intelligence and feminine self-assurance. Yet she also shows the suffering and uncertainty of a lonely human being. Stuttgart Zeitung wrote that review. The film belongs to Jane Fonda. She portrays a prostitute who is both the classic victim and the captain of her fate. James Monaco, American Film Now. So again, detectives on the streets. The next film in the file is another Clint Eastwood film, Dirty Harry, the first Dirty Harry. Don Siegel directed again. So he directed The Beguiled and Dirty Harry with Clint Eastwood in the same year. So they were busy together, working together. So I know that this film, I've got it. I haven't watched it. I've got all the Dirty Harrys to watch eventually. The titles are going in my pot of films that I own that I haven't watched yet. But isn't this based on sort of the hunt for the Zodiac Killer? They go and watch it during Zodiac, don't they? Isn't he called Zodiac in this? No, Scorpio. Scorpio. But pretty sure that they said that the detective in this is based on the detective who was portrayed by Mark Ruffalo in David Fincher's Zodiac. A killer lurks on the rooftops of San Francisco. A young woman becomes his first victim. Sensuously following her movements from his telescopic lens, he watches her rise from her lounge chair on top of a high rise across the way, dive elegantly into the pool. The killer lets her swim a few laps and then squeezes the trigger. The clear water in the light blue pool turns dark red and the girl momentarily flails about, then dies in a thick cloud of her own blood. Police Inspector Harry Callahan scrutinises the crime scene from the killer's perspective, clearly a voyeuristic spot. But it is all too apparent that what had once been pleasure watching has now become a pleasure in killing. And the killing has just one objective: to kill a person a day if he doesn't receive $1,000. Dirty Harry, sort of playing on that serial killer threat. I'm sure America was in Zodiac fever during this time, where he was threatening, you know, to kill people and children coming off of school buses and things. And I think it all sort of gets covered in Dirty Harry. Without having watched it, I can't really comment too much. The next is Silent Running. It's sort of a low budget science fiction film from director Douglas Trumbull. Now, Douglas Trumbull is a visual effects. He's a legend, really. He helped create the Stargate sequence in 2001, A Space Odyssey. He's done that amazing sequence in the middle of Terrence Malick's Tree of Life. I don't know if you've ever seen that film, but where she's praying to God why her son died. And then in answer, Terrence Malick shows you that, you know, he's almost answering as God, but just shows this massive sequence of the dawn of time from the Big Bang and everything that comes before it. And it's just all evolution. And we just... it's a really impressive visual, stunning sequence. Anyway, that was Douglas Trumbull, directed Silent Running. Also designed the suit for the man who killed Hitler and then the Bigfoot, if I remember correctly as well. So Trumbull's film is set in 2008. Of course it is. We was all flying around in space by then. After a nuclear catastrophe, the Earth is devoid of plants and animals. All that could be saved was shot into space and is on its way to the planet Saturn. The Valley Forge floats in space like a kind of Noah's Ark, one of numerous spaceships that serve as greenhouses, literal Garden of Eden with lush plants, cascading waterfalls in which deer, rabbits, turtles and frogs can live without worry. Astrobotanist Freeman Lowell, played by Bruce Dern, and his crew of colleagues make sure that the flora and fauna are well maintained and preserved until a time when suitable living conditions prevail once more on the planet Earth. But an unexpected order comes. The experiment is to be terminated, the artificial biospheres are to be destroyed, and the man-made paradise abandoned. When ordered to destroy his beloved forest, Freeman goes mad. So, you know, again, science fiction. 1969 just saw man land on the moon, so this is all sort of part of that zeitgeist as well, isn't it? what going up into space, and we're here to save the planet, you know. It's a film that I've not seen, but it's one that I've listened to a podcast where it's been watched. I think I might have heard a couple of podcasts discuss this film. It says, Lowell, this is the quote, Lowell is an old-fashioned, unreconstructed plant freak, an organic food loon who keeps the conservationist's pledge pasted next to his bunk. I can't really discuss that much more. I haven't really seen it. The next one I haven't seen either, another detective film, but this one is another Oscar winner as well. Oscar for Best Song, Isaac Hayes, the theme from Shaft. That's right, 1971's Shaft is next detective film thriller. He's a complicated man, but no one understands him but his woman. I'll just read the opening paragraph here. We got a big picture of Richard Roundtree as John Shaft. It says, now and again, a film comes along that strikes the nerve of its age with instinctive certainty. Shaft, developed as a technically simple, low-budget project with neither expensive stars nor a renowned director, became the surprise hit of 1971 and saved MGM Studios from looming bankruptcy. With Shaft, the multi-talented Gordon Park Sr. developed a unique language of images still referred to in the iconography of today's rap videos. So, yeah, again, new audiences stepping up, Black American finally being spoken for and represented in films. It says here from Essence magazine, Shaft is the first picture to show a black man who leads a life free of racial torment. He is black and proud of it, but not obsessed with it. Then it goes over to Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange, which is the film that, you know, as I said, he's discussed quite a lot in the opening of the book. Vidi well, my little brother, Vidi well. So I don't know if you've seen A Clockwork Orange, based on the novel of the same name by Anthony Burgess. No Oscars here. But yeah, Clockwork Orange was banned in England until Stanley Kubrick's death in 1999. The director himself had withdrawn it in 1974, and the motivation for his self-censorship remains obscure. Perhaps he had simply grown tired of being blamed for glorifying violence. But it's possible he had actually been threatened. So, yeah, ultra-violence following Alex and his droogs as they go around robbing, murdering, raping. It's an interesting film. It's very, it looks very 60s, doesn't it? It looks, I don't know, it's a strange film. The scene where, you know, it is the rape scene, isn't it? Where they're running around with that, like, large phallus thing. Definitely going to more dark, surreal places, pushing the envelopes, pushing the boundaries of what's acceptable and what's been done before. And, you know, suddenly, this is what I mean. These films are unlike anything that sort of emerged before. You know, it's not like the delinquents of the 50s movies or the 60s, you know, with their quiffs and cigarettes rolled up in their collars. And this is a whole new, you know, it's a strange looking film, but the themes and the actual display of violence just never been done before. Right, 1971's possibly the most successful film of this year. It certainly has at the moment on the page turnover, and you can see it's won 5 Academy Awards, Oscars for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Gene Hackman, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Film Editing. It is the French Connection. Police film, that's what it says, is the genre. Now, I've read the book of this as well, and I've watched the film, obviously, Best Director, William Friedkin. Discussed him just a couple of weeks as we compared Wages of Fear to Sorcerer. Now, the 70s was, up until The Sorcerer flopped anyway, was Friedkin's decade, really. You know, he was one of the ones who pushed boundaries. Gene Hackman, was this possibly his first starring role? I know he had like a supporting role in Bonnie and Clyde, but him and Roy Scheider here play Popeye Doyle and Buddy Cloudy Russo. They're basically two cops that sort of surveilling the sort of the drug scene, and they soon realise there's a link to like a French drugs boss, and they're just trying to get to the end of it. They're typical buddy cops, always winding up the chief, set in and around New York. It says over page here from Steadicam, if you start counting movie moments in The French Connection, you'll have to stop by about number 8. It's simply impossible to keep up, unless you can count to 9. But I know what he means. There is some just great performances. It is one of the ultimate cop movies, isn't it? Gene Hackman is fantastic in it. But Friedkin's directing, again, a lot of handheld, you know, they're not police in shiny uniforms. These are police who talk down to each other. They rough up people that they're investigating. Friedkin says, many things I experienced close up as a child went into The French Connection. I knew how policemen deal with one another. There's one of the best car chases in it at the end, where he's chasing the train, driving under the subway. The legendary stories there of Friedkin operating the camera and just getting in with the stunt driver and going, like, just drive. Allegedly, that's how it plays out. There's a lot of fantastic stories with Friedkin's films, but that's one of them. It just makes me want to go back and watch all these films. I will have to. Next is Play It Again, Sam, 1971 comedy, written and directed by Woody Allen. So I've not actually seen this film. Woody Allen's a funny one to me. I do like some of his comedies, some of his romances, but they all seem a bit the same. Anyway, I always found I was disappointed when Woody Allen films would clean up at the awards and you think, well, he's just done the same thing he's done again. And then, like, some really great films would sort of go unnoticed, unrecognized at the award ceremonies, you know. And of course now, you know, with this scandals that have happened, he's one of those actors that he's still producing work, but, you know, lost a lot of his fan base, I should think. But the synopsis for Play It Again, Sam: a neurotic, mild-mannered film critic is dumped by his wife and his ego's crushed. His hero persona is the tough guy played by Humphrey Bogart in many of his movies, and the apparition of Bogart begins showing up to give him advice. Does sound a bit of a good comedy. Who's playing Bogart, I wonder? Let's have a look. Jerry Lacey. Don't know who that is. It says, a poignant and a hilarious ode to Humphrey Bogart films and physical comedy. Woody Allen's Play It Again, Sam is not only underrated, but should even be considered a comedy masterpiece. Play It Again, Sam is a mostly successful mix of one-liners, pathos, and visual humour. Allen mixes his usual soup of anxious personalities, observations on the human condition, and difficulties of being a geek to fine effect. But, I mean, that's what, to me, Woody Allen films sort of done that to death. Do you know what I mean? They all seem, every time another film of his come out, I'd be like, oh, he's playing that character again. The next film is a film I'm afraid I've not heard of. It's a foreign film, an Italian-French film called Fellini's Roma. Fellini's Roma needs no dramatic storyline and has only one protagonist, Fellini himself. In a series of episodes, he tells how he dreamt as a child of the alluring city and how he arrived there as a young man in 1939. This film is classed as grotesque in the genre, written and directed by Federico Fellini. As Rome to Fellini, so Dublin to Joyce. It's hard to think of another film director as close to a city as Fellini is to Rome. Haven't really seen that. The next film I have seen, there's a whole episode that I've done with my brother on this film, actually, which is Harold and Maude, 1971. Tragicomedy, satire, it says. Again, no awards mentioned here. The French Connection had them all. So, Bud Cort, Ruth Gordon, if you haven't seen this film, it's well worth digging out. I think it's a great film. It's quite a poignant sort of movie. It follows Bud Cort, who, again, another sort of boy from a well-to-do family who obviously feels the guilt of it. You know, that's a lot of it, isn't it? These people, they're born into wealth. They don't feel they deserve it. They don't feel they want it. They don't feel it gives them to be born into sort of these aristocrat families. They haven't got time to find. In this film, Bud Cort plays Harold, is obsessed with suicide and death. And he fakes his death for his mum to find him. Because didn't he say that he'd attempted suicide once and all of a sudden he had his mother's full attention. So now he keeps doing it, but she just doesn't even react. But then he's at a funeral and he meets this old lady called Maud, and they begin this romantic liaison, him, a teenager, and her sort of at the end of her days. One of the highlighted comments on here is, Harold and Maud is a poeticized slice of American life in which automobile graveyards, garbage dumps, slums and junkyards are all awakened to new life. The film is a ballad, an allegory of life and death, in which life is ultimately triumphant. When Harold and Maud hit American theatres in 1971, the write-up says, the offbeat love story about a stoic 16-year-old boy and an 80-year-old woman flopped at the box office. It was not until 1979, when the picture was re-released, that it triumphed with audiences. So even though this film, directed by Hal Ashby, quite like a lot of his work, I mean, the guy's like an old tramp when you see him, but yeah, he's made some good films in the 70s. I don't know, I wonder if any more will pop up as we go on. But Harold and Maud, yeah, there's a whole episode on that. It's well worth going and having a listen to. And I think this is the last film, is The Last Picture Show, directed by Peter Bogdanovich, written by Larry McMurtry. Peter Bogdanovich, based on the novel of the same name by Larry McMurtry. Now, this is a small town film. Timothy Bottoms, Jeff Bridges, Sybil Shepherd, and Ben Johnson. Ellen Burstyn, good cast here. Randy Quaid, a young Randy Quaid, and Sam Bottoms. They're basically all, it's about these kids growing up in this little town, Dust Bowl town in Texas in the 50s. I've reviewed this film. I think it was one of the first films I owned that I haven't watched yet that I'd done. So if you scroll back again to one of the early episodes there, you might find me discussing this film. I really liked it. It was it's filmed in black and white. It's won two awards, it says. Oscars for Best Supporting Actress, Cloris Leachman, and Best Supporting Actor, Ben Johnson. So this Peter Bogdanovich was another one of those directors who, you know, rise through the ranks of Roger Corman's production company and was given the opportunity to direct this film. It's his second feature film, but I think it's his first feature for a studio. It says, director Bogdanovich, 31, has achieved a tactile sense of time and place. That is enough to herald him as the most exciting new director in America today. This is not merely the best American movie of a rather dreary year. It is the most impressive work by a young American director since Citizen Kane, Newsweek. So a lot of love for Peter Bogdanovich, The Last Picture Show there. It's a sort of just a little drama. There's not a lot of action in it, but it's just a really intriguing story. You're just watching these kids and some great performances. I mean, to see a young Jeff Bridges, just fantastic. So that's all the films he covers. The first chapter, 1971. He's bound to have missed some out. Other films that come out that year, I'm just going into my internet now. If we go through popularity, number one was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Two, three, four, all been mentioned. Clockwork Orange, Last Picture Show, Get Carter. This is IMDb. French Connection, Dirty Harry. James Bond was still going with Diamonds Are Forever, which was that the last Sean Connery film, wasn't it? Bedknobs and Broomsticks, Disney were kicking out there. Sort of live action movies still at this point. Walkabout, Nicholas Roeg, isn't it? Nicholas Roeg's Walkabout. Two city-bred siblings are stranded in the Australian outback where they learn to survive with the aid of an Aboriginal boy on his walkabout, a ritual separation for his tribe, Jenny Agutter and David Gulphill. It's quite a good film from the year. Carnal Knowledge, director Mike Nichols from The Graduate. That film, again, following the theme of sort of a sexual revolution, stars Jack Nicholson. Isn't Art Garfunkel in that? Yeah, Art Garfunkel. Candice Bergen, Anne Margaret. Chronicling the lifelong sexual development of two men who meet and become friends in college. Another film that came out this year that flopped big style was George Lucas's debut movie, THX 1138. In the 25th century, a time when people have designations instead of names. A man, THX1138, and a woman, LUH3417, rebel against their rigidly controlled society. There we are. It's the little man being controlled and manipulated by the authorities again, shining through. Actually, I really like this film. It's not Star Wars, and people weren't interested to watch it when it came out. It's a real shame, but it is a really interesting film, and based on George Lucas's first, a film that won him a load of awards when he was at UCLA, made a short movie called THX1138. Would later go on to name his THX sound after it, wouldn't he? There you go. And then it's like there's some sequels, another Planet of the Apes film kicking out, The Andromeda Strain, The Omega Man. So a lot of this is a great film. The Blood on Satan's Claw. Don't know if you've ever seen this, British sort of gothic horror film. That was a really good one from 1971. Is there any there you can think of? Any films you might think, hey, Trev, you've missed that boy. So yeah, that was 1971. Quick look through that. I hope you've enjoyed this. It's a bit different, but you know, I love the 70s, as I said. There's a few films there I haven't seen. Maybe I'll have to dig them out. But next time we come back to visit here, we'll have a look at 1972. So do your research, people. Mention if there's any films you hope will be mentioned in here. So that's all I've got time for today. Next time you hear from me, I probably will concentrate on a single film again. If you want to get in touch, then please do so. You can go on Instagram, you can go on Facebook, find us on there, WN Movie Talk or WN Movie Talk Podcast. We're on YouTube, as I mentioned. I haven't done any videos on there for a little while, though. I will have to try and kick something out. Or you can get hold of us at wnmovietalk@gmail.com. That's wnmovietalk@gmail.com. Let me know if there's a film you'd like reviewed or a topic you'd like discussed. You know, I'm trying to do different things with this show now, just to sort of keep it moving and keep it flowing. So yeah, hope you're enjoying this anyway, and you never know, Sunday I might have someone come back and have a chat with me on air, but for the time being it's just me on my own, so sorry about that. Anyway, thank you again for listening, and I will see you all again soon. Chase.